My name's Emily. I am an emergency nurse and I worked at the Royal Brisbane for just under 15 years. During that time there, I also had the opportunity to work as a life flight helicopter nurse for 5 years. And I worked as the disaster liaison clinical nurse consultant for the Health Disaster Management Unit. I currently am both a Winston Churchill Fellow and a Sir John Monash Scholar, and I'm working in Southeast Asia for the International Committee of the Red Cross as a pre-hospital health delegate.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us. As you've just mentioned, you've been an emergency nurse for more than 15 years. You've worked at the Royal, you've worked in health disaster management, as well as Life Flight. What drew you to these roles?
Yeah, for me growing up, I think there was a strong realisation about the need for health equality. I found it really interesting when I learned about different cultures and different healthcare systems that Australia has this really strong and solidified system, but it's particularly useful in cities. And I found that health equality is such a major issue within rural and remote areas because I grew up in the country. So that's what drew me to working for Life Flight. And it was something that I really believed in because I felt that we needed to bring that tertiary level healthcare from the city into country and remote areas. From an emergency perspective, I was drawn to the fast pace and the understanding of society from its warist perspective, which is what you see in the emergency department. I find the work really interesting and I feel like I have a really meaningful impact on my community by working within an emergency department.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a town called Mount Barker, which is in Western Australia. So it's a couple of hours drive outside of Albany. And it was a really small Indigenous population community where, you know, I got to sort of understand different cultures. We had a significant immigrant population considering the size of the population. And my grandparents actually were also refugees who came over after the Second World War. So it was a bit of a melting pot, and that's sort of what drew me to different cultures and different understandings of people's lives.
Emily, if we fast forward to 2020, when you took on the role of health delegate for the International Committee of the Red Cross, what inspired you to take on this role and what does your work involve?
Yeah, so it was sort of a little bit of a backstory. In 2016, I was involved in a mass casualty incident in Vanuatu, where I was part of the aeromedical retrieval evacuation team. And when I was over there, I saw once again this health inequalities, and it made me realise that within Australia, you know, we're sitting here with amazing healthcare systems, but just so close to home, there's a lack of healthcare systems in so many different countries. So I applied for the Winston Churchill Fellowship, which I was granted $28,000 to go over to America and study a Diploma of Humanitarian Assistance at Fordham University in New York City. And it was during that period of time that I was mainly studying with people who worked either for large NGOs, the ICRC or the United Nations. And I got to see what they were doing and the impact that they were having in their career. And I was really drawn to that aspect. I think that you can have so much of an impact in this, in the humanitarian space. And I'm really proud of the work that I'm able to do. So after New York, I went to Geneva and I spent a couple of months in Geneva as well as Rome and Sweden, and I did research with some of the United Nations bodies there, as well as the Swedish National Air Medevac Service. So I got to once again look at different cultures and how people are doing things differently, and all of these elements came back, and that's what changed my individual practice. So when I came back to Australia, I was asked by Fordham University if I would once again go back to Europe and be part of their teaching faculty for their International Diploma of Humanitarian Assistance in Switzerland, which is what I did. And so I spent a couple of months in Switzerland at the end of 2019 teaching. And during that time, I had the opportunity to meet some people from the ICRC or the International Committee of the Red Cross. and we went through their roles and what they were doing. And I was really drawn to the ICRC from the perspective of their upholding their humanitarian principles around, especially around impartiality and independence. So I gave them my CV. We had a discussion. And a few months later, my now boss gave me a call and we went through the interview process and I was offered the position. So here what I'm doing is I'm actually based out of Southeast Asia for a few more weeks and then I will be going likely to Jordan. And I'm working at capacity building here from a disaster management perspective to try and interlock what we have on the ground with the ambulance service and increasing the capacity of the healthcare system. So it's a really interesting position and I have the opportunity to meet different and innovative people every day. And I feel like I have quite a strong impact on both the community and within my own profession doing this type of work.
Wow, what an amazing couple of years you've had.
Yeah, it's been very, like it really, the opportunities that have come out of the Winston Churchill Fellowship were amazing. And it was such a journey. It really changed my perspective on who I was as a person and what I wanted to be and how I wanted to change my life to go on to do things that were different to what I had been doing. So, yeah, it's been an amazing transition.
And you mentioned that at the moment your work in Southeast Asia is around capacity building. So what might a typical day look like for you?
Yeah, so a large section of it is looking at education. So we work on teaching anything from a whole variety of aspects. So we can teach very basic first aid training to individuals who may have had no education whatsoever to try and reduce the instances of mortality associated with trauma prior to being able to get to a hospital. Remembering that some of these communities will never have the opportunity to set foot into a hospital, both because they don't have enough money or there's not enough resources or there's just no hospital system in some of the areas that the ICRC works. So we go from that to effectively strengthening the actual amenity medical system that they have or looking at their ambulance system to try and improve that from that perspective and see how they can use education as a tool to try and improve the pre-hospital perspective and treatment of many of these patients.
So most of your work then is with the community rather than healthcare workers as such, or a bit of both?
Predominantly it's with the community. So yeah. We really look at it from a pre-hospital perspective.
It's such great work, Emily.
Yeah, it's really interesting as well. And the reason I like it is I really enjoy the melting pot of cultures that come in to do it, not only from the mobile staff that come in internationally to work for the ICRC, but predominantly from the local staff. I've learned so much from people here. They've taught me so much innovation and resilience, and there's so many things that I think that I lacked in my personal practice when I was working predominantly in a westernised system.
So, Emily, late last year you were awarded the prestigious Sir John Monash Scholarship. This will allow you to complete a PhD exploring why women remain vulnerable to domestic violence during and after disasters. So congratulations on your scholarship.
Thank you.
What drove you to this research? It's such an important topic.
So disaster management is something I'm really interested and passionate about, and it's effectively where I've targeted my career. And it never really occurred to me prior to the last couple of years, particularly doing the study I did in New York, that women are still vulnerable. And I think there's a perception about gender equality that we've achieved it. And disasters impact women so much that it becomes evident that we haven't achieved equality. And we see this currently with what's going on with COVID, because we have COVID happening and there's surging rates globally of domestic violence. And a lot of this is attributed to negative and toxic gender stereotyping, where we look at these perceptions of what is a man and what is a woman and how that is compounded into increased toxicity during a disaster. So for me, I became more and more interested in it. And then when COVID did happen and I saw it in my own country, I started to do a bit of research on it. And I looked at what was happening with the Australian bushfires and how there were surging rates of domestic violence during that period of time. And a lot of the research was showing about this toxic masculinity that we have in so many cultures. So that's when I looked at applying for the Sir John Monash Scholarship. I was a successful applicant. So I'm really excited by the research that I have the potential to do, because I do think that it's a really important area. And I like the fact that gender is a dialogue that's still being opened. And I think that it's opening even more after this current disaster that we're in of COVID.
Emily, it's extremely important research that you're doing. So how will you do it? What will it involve and what do you hope to achieve?
Yeah, so I'm really fortunate. I've had the opportunity to meet quite a few international gender experts, and it was through them that I decided to apply for the University of Amsterdam, where I have two supervisors there. What I would like to do is I would like to look at my field research to be split between both a high income earning country and a low income earning country, so a developing and a developed, to see the differences and to look at the gender stereotyping from both perspectives to see if it's compounded with the difference within the GDP of the country. So what I'd like to effectively do is formulate a framework that will be used as a health diplomacy tool, that during a disaster we can bring a gendered lens to any disaster. I recently was talking to people from the World Bank, and we were discussing the concept of how gender as a lens can often be ignored, and it's not a deliberate ignoring, it's more that when you're coming at it from a developed country perspective, you forget the nuances that you see in a developing country in relation to power shifts, because they're not so evident within developed countries. I think that the inequalities that we have in Australia are a lot more subtle, and that's why they're hard to see, but they're still very much there. For me, I think that everyone has an opinion on gender equality, but there are a few people that actually want to get an education on it. And I don't know, I find it a really interesting debate. So that's where my research is trying to look at that and trying to improve that education from a health perspective.
And Emily, the field research, how will you go about doing that?
I'm still trying to find where I would like to do my field research. Mm-hmm. However, I'm really interested in disasters from a climate perspective. So I'm looking at within Central America, and looking at which countries there have quite significant impacts from a climate change perspective, and how that disaster in itself will actually influence women. And then what I would like to do is go and spend a few months in Central America and do my field research there. I want to do mixed methods so that I've got both aspects, because I sometimes find that if you only use it from a qualitative research perspective, you might lose a section of the health population who are less interested in that sort of style. So I would like to mix it up and look at both qualitative and quantitative methodology within my research, and then base it back in the Netherlands.
And how will your research then apply to non-climate change disasters like COVID-19, for instance?
So I would like to make the framework from the health diplomacy tool to be quite broad, and base it on international frameworks within disaster management, such as the Sendai, the UN Sendai framework. And this way it can be a reasonably broad basic understanding that can be applied to any disaster. For me, the field work I would like to focus on the climate change perspective, because I think that that will be really important research that I can bring back to Australia, because we are effectively at the coalface of climate change, and unfortunately we're still not doing enough about it. And so for me, I think that this style of research we can apply to a whole number of things, but because I think the compounding vulnerabilities that are associated with disasters and gender are the same regardless of the actual disaster, from a very broad perspective.
Emily, finally, I read about what you hope to have achieved in this space by the time you turn 50. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, for me, I would like to have created research that's not a theoretical exercise. I am a very practical person, having nursed for such a long time. I want something that can be used and can be applied into scenarios to sustainably benefit the population, both men and women, because these toxic gender roles are not good for men either. They put them in very vulnerable situations themselves. So I would like to have created this, and ultimately I'd like to be working as a gender in health expert, because I think that this denial of gender, the gender lens in so many applications that we currently see in processes and protocols and documents and reports, is not going to be able to be sustainable in the future, because from COVID, I think that we're currently coming into a period of social change as a result of these more evident and increasing inequalities between gender and race and climate. And there's so many interesting factors that have been brought out as a result of COVID. So for me, being a gender and health expert by the time I'm 50, I'd like to be able to apply this knowledge to so many different aspects. Ultimately, I would like to be working for a major think tank. And there are so many interesting ones that we have both in Australia and in Europe that look at social impact and feminism and healthcare change. And one of my big things that I would like to change is the conversation and dialogue around gender and feminism, and to talk about why we are so afraid of the word feminism. Mm. So I would like that to be my legacy by the time I retire. Not that I'm saying I will retire at 50, that would be an amazing dream, but yes, that would be something that I would like to look at.
You've had such an inspiring career already. Is there any advice you have for aspiring clinical leaders?
Yes. For me, the biggest change in my life was getting a mentor. Mm-hmm. And I can't recommend this enough to people, is mentorship is so important. I think that in all aspects of health, if it's physiotherapy to nursing to medicine, all aspects, you know, we go into university, we're told what to learn, we're told what to do, and then we come out and we're told exactly what to do within our workplace. And often we feel quite constrained, and I know a lot of my nursing colleagues always say, you know, I love nursing, but I don't know what to do. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do shift work. I don't want to have this life. But we don't have that. We don't see the changes that can happen and the amazing work that you can do from a healthcare perspective. And I think that having a mentor is somebody who can really draw out your strengths and show you your weaknesses that you effectively need to work on, so that you can be directed into an area that you really enjoy. And I've been very fortunate where I've had a few really strong mentors throughout my career. And, you know, it's an established mentorship relationship where I've literally asked them to be my mentor, and I've put in the work and the effort to effectively speak to them regularly and try and get their guidance. And I think that that is the most important thing that somebody can do if they are an aspiring leader or an aspiring clinician. But on the flip side, I think it's also really important that you know, our healthcare leaders give the opportunity and time to people who are aspiring and learning. And with that comes patience, and patience to see through their fumbling through their leadership and trying to understand it. And, you know, I've also been on the opposite side where I haven't been given the patience, or I've been overlooked or undermined, which is very common. You know, this is a common aspect of society. And I'm not saying that this was by men, because it was by men and particularly women. Sometimes that relationship between women and women, it can be very toxic. And I think that there needs to be a kindness that's associated with the leaders and the aspiring leaders. And with that kindness comes empathy and understanding, but particularly patience.
Amazing advice, Emily. Thank you so much. And thank you very much for talking with us today. We'll have to catch up again after your 50th to see where you are.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me today. It was a real honour to be here, and I was very excited. So thank you again.